I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you a house.
I would buy you a house.
I want to tell the folks about some of the classic, like, podcasting bloopers and blunders. If you're recording on Zoom or on, you know, some online platform, there's like, is your mic connected to the laptop? That's a big one. Is the input audio device the mic and not the laptop microphone? Did you remember to press record? These are all classic, classic.
I don't know, man. It's real breaking the fourth wall. I have to say, I feel a little naked kind of letting people who aren't podcasters in on this process. It feels very intimate, you know, giving them a peek behind the scenes, like to kind of some of the things that are on our minds, like, are the mics on? Are the inputs correct? Can we see each other? Can we hear about each other? Just some tricks of the trade for all you folks listening.
Classic thing. You open the Zoom. You see the other person. So that's great. You've made the video link. The internet is working. They start to talk. You hear nothing. And then it's like, okay, is it a problem on my end? Is it a problem on his end? You're convinced it's not a problem on your end. They're convinced it is a problem on your end. You're trying to have this debate while you can't even hear the other person. This is classic podcast stuff. Anyway, welcome to Michael and Us. I am Will Sloan, here as always with
Luke Savage. Welcome back, everyone.
So can I start by just quoting a tweet that I saw today? Again, classic podcast intro. This is by one Will Stancil. I don't know who Will Stancil is. I see his name.
Oh, dear. You're not in on the Will Stancil discourse. He's a real discourse guy.
I'm in on it because I see him all the time. I don't know who he is. Who is Will Stancil? Can you explain Will Stancil to me briefly?
He's a discourse guy. He's a guy that appears in the discourse. He does discourse. There's discourse about him. Yeah, that's all you need to know. And I refuse to learn anything more than that.
Okay, I was going to ask if he was like attached to like some institution larger than himself, but I guess I don't really.
Yeah, the discourse.
Right, okay, thank you. That I got it now. So today he posted, and I have no idea what context started this. It could be any number of issues. I'm just plucking this out of context and using this as a building block. He says, anyone who thinks I'm center-right is straight-up delusional. I'm a bleeding heart progressive who understands that complicated problems need to be broken down piece by piece and can't be solved in one fell swoop with the power of belief. So this is something we've been seeing for my entire life, this kind of framing. Nothing new here, pretty standard cliche center-right thing to say. But he posted it in a week that was primed to make me annoyed because, of course, we've seen all week the cops busting peaceful protests on campuses, seeing so much nuance mongering, as you like to say, so much clever discourse. So many people who are on the right side of history are more on the right side of history than you, which is why they really understand what history is. So a couple of things. Since last week when we watched The Devil Probably, that movie has been kind of rattling around in my brain quite a bit. There's something in what that movie captures, this ambient feeling of hopelessness and how do you respond to the hopelessness? Are things really hopeless? That really speaks to me at this moment. These campus protests we've been seeing at Columbia and elsewhere, they've been a very high-profile part of a six-month protest movement that shows no signs of slowing about what's happening in Gaza. The protests keep getting bigger. They keep getting more insistent. So far, they have failed to stop the bloodshed. And so when you see that incredible disconnect between popular opinion and policy and elite opinion, there is part of you that sort of wants to respond to that like the character of Charles does in The Devil Probably. You know, okay, it's hopeless. Why not opt out of society at this point? The problem is too great. I don't necessarily have a rebuttal to what Charles does at the end of that movie, but if these protests have accomplished nothing else so far, they've really shown a lot of things for what they really are. A lot of people, a lot of institutions, a lot of political figures, a lot of policymakers, a lot of take-havers and nuance mongers. And that's been very clarifying. But to return to what Will Stancil was saying, I was reminded of a quote that's been going around. I'm not sure who said it originally. A liberal is someone who is against every war except the current war and for every civil rights struggle except the civil rights struggle that's happening right now.
And you can extend that for every union drive except not for this one.
Right.
It's not appropriate for this kind of workplace. Guys, we're a team, you know?
And you know, this is so clever, isn't it? This idea that, you know, I'm a progressive, but I'm the one who understands that progress can't all happen all at once. And it can't come because of magical thinking, which that's what they think. And what I would say to Will Stancil or all the Will Stancils of the world is, okay, taking it as granted that problems don't get solved in one fell swoop, what do you want to be? Do you want to be the guy who's reminding everyone that problems can't all be solved in one fell swoop? Or do you want to be the person who's part of the drive to solve the problems? You're an opinion haver. You're a member of the discourse. You're a shaper of the discourse. What do you want to use that minimal power for? Because we've all got a role to play here. Is your role that you're helping shift the Overton window? Or is your role the guy saying how hard it is to shift the Overton window?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of thing gets incredibly tiresome for a number of reasons. I mean, one, because as you said, well, you know, we've been hearing versions of this for 25 years. This is a posture that is very common among a certain type of commentator, invariably a sort of a centrist or a center-right one, somebody who aspires to respectability, someone who, yeah, partakes in the discourse, thinks of the discourse as sort of a category of its own, identifies with the discourse on an almost an aesthetic level, is very invested in being the type of guy and feels most comfortable being the type of guy who, whenever anything is happening, breaks through the wall like the Kool-Aid man and says, oh, wait, but what about process? What about detail? What about whatever?
To which I would say, what about process? You know, he writes that complicated problems need to be broken down piece by piece. Okay, what is your role in that breaking down? What do you contribute to this process? Because right now your contribution is to say, complicated problems need to be broken down.
That's right. I mean, this posture is primarily, well, it's a posture. It's affective. You scratch the surface of this sentiment, what you often find is that the solutions being offered, such as they are, you know, the wonkery and stuff, is all pretty generic. It's not very interesting. You know, I think here of what Matt Iglesias has been trading in for, you know, going on a quarter century at this point. You know, he's somebody who loves to impress upon everybody that he's thinking about details. He's a wonk. You know, he doesn't just have high-minded sentiment. You know, he's grounded in reality. And then what you find when you actually look at his wonkery is that it's just like the most, you know, he's a generalist. He's an expert on whatever he needs to be at a given time. What his actual views or values are, you know, kind of oscillates with the time. It's whatever he needs to do to build his brand. But the thing that is consistent is, yeah, this constant posture of like, look, I'm the one that thinks about detail. I'm the guy who thinks about nuance, not, you know, pure belief, yada, yada, yada. All that shit's very annoying. But on a more basic level, this posture annoys me for a simpler reason, which is just every guy who talks like that, you know, you can extend this to a certain kind of like cable news pundit that brands themselves as a political strategist or worked as a political strategist at one point, certain kinds of, you know, pollsters, qua public intellectuals who trade in these sentiments that's like, well, if the left wants to advance its goals, it needs to first win elections. Actually, you know, Will, I don't know if you saw, but friend of the pod, Alex Garland, director of the hit film Civil War, which we discussed on a recent Patreon episode, which people can hear at patreon.com/Michael and us, he went on our sister podcast, Pod Save America, formerly Keeping It 1600. And this was one of the insights that he delivered. You know, if the left wants to win and advance its ideas, first it needs to win elections.
Can somebody ask Alex Garland what he thinks about Gaza? I'd like to hear him like well, talk about an issue, okay?
But I'm not even thinking here of anything that's going on right now. I'm thinking of 25 years of people making statements like this. Everyone who talks like this is always acting as if, first of all, it's a really penetrating insight. And second of all, as if they're kind of the first person that's ever advanced this idea. Like, oh, you know, in politics, you actually have to persuade people. You have to make people agree with you and bring them over to your point of view. It's like, yeah, I think most people understand that. It is so unbelievably facile. Anyway, to return to the more current point that you've raised, I mean, you are yourself an alumnus of Columbia University, and I believe it's the case, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that Columbia has actually made something of a brand out of campus occupations that occurred in opposition to the Vietnam War. A tweet I really liked that someone posted this week: if you're involved in any of these anti-genocide actions at universities, please make sure to save your emails, flyers, and other papers so that in 50 years, your university can proudly display them as part of their special collections. I think that's very on point.
What was that point about liberals again?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, there's a wider generational point to be made here. And, you know, with the usual caveats, hashtag not all boomers, it applies to a certain kind of, you know, liberal progressive baby boomer who's built, you know, much of their identity on the fact that, like, yeah, look, I marched. I was against the war. I was against the draft. I went to sit-ins, yada, yada, yada. But here's why I support the Patriot Act. Here's why I support the war on terror because I'm a liberal. Here's why I think that the students currently occupying Columbia and various other university campuses, I think that they might be getting funding from Russia and China.
By the way, they're disrupting other students' educations. God forbid that happen. How do you feel about the TikTok ban, by the way?
I'm going to take a contrarian position and say that I am fully in favor of it because I used TikTok for about 30 seconds once and I felt my brain atrophying. No, I don't know. Look, I haven't been following it very closely. I don't personally use TikTok because I find it too addictive and I have enough addictive social media things that I already use. But I don't think there's too much to be said about it, right? It's the product of a couple things. It's piggybacking on a sort of wider and, you know, more longstanding panic about disinformation, about how, you know, social media is a form of sorcery that injects bad ideas into unwitting recipients, which is how Donald Trump got elected. It's how Brexit happened. It's how everything bad in the last decade happened. It's piggybacking on that, but it also has to do with, you know, geopolitical competition between the United States and China. I don't think there's anything more to it than that. I don't have too much to add on the protests at Columbia, although they do make me think of something that Howard Zinn said in 1971. They'll say we're disturbing the peace, but there is no peace. What really bothers them is that we are disturbing the war. So off the top there, well, you said you couldn't really conjure a rebuttal to the sentiment in The Devil Probably, which we talked about last week. I disagree. I think the rebuttal is right there in these sit-ins. Related, but closer to home for Will and myself, the Ontario legislature, which in fact I can see from my window and where I used to work, I suppose 10 years ago now, for the Ontario New Democratic Party, the Speaker of the House recently passed a ban on wearing of the keffiyeh by members. In fact, I saw just before we started recording, Sarah Jama, a former member of the NDP caucus, who now sits and is an independent, she's been asked to leave because, you know, she wore the keffiyeh yesterday, and I guess the Speaker didn't notice, but today, it having made the news, someone did notice, and she was ejected. Now, nominally, this ban has been advanced as part of a ban on political symbols. As I understand it, according to the established rules, elected lawmakers in the Ontario legislature, and I think the House of Commons in Ottawa as well, actually do need to secure permission, I think, from the Speaker to wear certain things that are considered political symbols. So any sort of ribbon day or anything like that. You know, what even needs to be said about a ban like this? It's clearly politically motivated. It's clearly discriminatory. The only way to consistently have a ban like this, I mean, because look, obviously the keffiyeh in the present context is a political symbol, and that's actually what's giving it its power. That when, you know, when Sarah Jama wears it in the legislature, when four or five members of the federal NDP caucus were wearing it a few weeks ago when they voted for the motion in parliament to end arms sales to Israel, you know, they're making a political statement. So the only way to be even remotely consistent here, if you are advancing the idea that political symbols should be banned in this context, is to ban all of them. So no ribbon days, no flags for Ukraine, nothing. Clearly, that's not what's going on here. Anyway, to introduce a little bit of levity into the discussion, there was something pretty funny that happened. This came courtesy of the Progressive Conservative government house leader at Queen's Park, one Paul Calandra. Now, some Canadian listeners will be intimately familiar with Paul Calandra because he was a sort of famous doofus who secured national attention in the dying days of the Stephen Harper era as, I believe his title was Parliamentary Secretary to the Prime Minister, which is not a cabinet position. It's sort of a a made-up thing. You know, these parliamentary secretaries, it's not always clear what they do. In his case, it meant that his job was to get up every day and just whatever the question was, he was going to filibuster with stuff that had absolutely nothing to do with the question. And Paul Calandra took this to a level that was basically performance art. So famously, in response to questions about, I believe it was the robocall scandal, don't have time to get into what that was, you know, questions about political corruption. There were a lot of corruption scandals at the end of the Harper era. He got up and started talking about how his daughters, they started a lemonade stand or something like that. There'd be a question about something completely different. And he would stand up and say, Mr. Speaker, the leader of the NDP seems to have a problem with Israel or something like that. This ended after weeks of, I mean, this was deeply humiliating for even, I think, the government side of the House. Like, it became too embarrassing for them. This was the talk of like every news panel for weeks, you know, longtime pundits saying, you know, I've covered Parliament for 40 years and I have never seen anything as embarrassing or degrading as what Paul Calandra is doing. Paul Calandra ended up making a tearful apology and then I think he was sort of duly benched. He's since become part of a grand tradition, which is people who can't make it at the federal level sort of being sent, you know, to the farm team, can't play for the Leafs. We're gonna send you to play for the Marlies for a while. So he ended up at Queen's Park. The same happens there too, by the way. Sometimes people can't hack it at Queen's Park and then they go and do whatever annoying shit they were doing at the municipal level. Anyway, Paul Calandra is now doing at Queen's Park a version of what he was doing in Parliament, albeit in the much more important role of government House Leader. And this week when the Kefia ban was being debated, he got up and basically did the Columbus Day episode from The Sopranos.
I don't take any lessons from the leader of the opposition when it comes to how people, marginalized people, feel. I'm an Italian-Canadian.
I love all of the applause. My God, I'm there with them, you know?
I mean, this rules. Yeah, in the same rant, he said something about how in like 1970, someone spat on him and called him a WOP because he was Italian. There were a number of people who sort of came to Paul Calandra's defense. The right-wing columnist, Brian Lilly, former contributor to the far-right website Rebel News, he suggested that, you know, anti-Italian prejudice is rank in our society. He referred to the phenomenon of Italian internment during the Second World War. Several hundred people of Italian descent were detained during the Second World War, although it was in no way comparable to the same experience had by people of Japanese descent. But yeah, Brian Lilly suggested that a lot of anti-developer prejudice today is rooted in anti-Italian sentiment, which I think is so funny because I don't know about you, Will, I don't even associate developers with Italians. I have no idea where that's coming from.
I actually feel like this is, in a circuitous way, anti-Semitic. He's trying to take anti-Semitic tropes and apply them to Italians.
Anyway, look, that shit from Paul Calandra, as ever, is beyond parody. Nothing more needs to be said about it. But before we get to the next segment, we'll just leave you with him talking about lemonade stands.
It's always very nice to see such a collegial atmosphere in the House, Mr. Speaker. I do like flowers, and of course, with lemons, I like to make lemonade, Mr. Speaker. My two daughters this summer actually had a lemonade stand, Mr. Speaker. They sold lemonade for 5 cents on the street, Mr. Speaker. They did very well, Mr. Speaker. I'm very proud of them. I'm very proud of them, Mr. Speaker, and I appreciate the honorable member again. I thank you very much for those kind words, Mr. Speaker, and I look forward to the rest of the debate.
Well, this isn't really a political subject, except in a peripheral sense, but I did want to share it with you because, you know, you are working on a book. We can be public about that now.
That is true.
It's very exciting, everyone. Round of applause for Will. He's working on a book.
Yeah, stay tuned. You'll hear more about it soon.
Yeah, I've been following this project for some years. Will's shared some of it with me, and it's going to be really good. But that's all we can say for now. In any case, Will, as somebody who will be having a book come out at some point in the future, I do have a few sobering statistics for you about the state of the publishing industry, which you and our listeners may find very interesting.
I'm counting on selling the movie rights.
Yeah, well, you got to make sure that in your contract, there's a clause about, optioning it. And in your case, you know, fortunately, no big director has made a movie about the subject before. So you'll be in a good stead there.
Excellent.
Anyway, the stats I'm about to share with you come via a blogger by the name of L. Griffin and from a post post called No One Buys Books, Everything We Learned About the Publishing Industry from Penguin versus DOJ. So in 2022, Penguin Random House wanted to buy Simon & Schuster, one of the other big publishing houses. So there's now this antitrust case being pursued by the U.S. Department of Justice. And I haven't been following the case itself too closely, but I have very much been following the absolutely eye-popping statistics about book sales, about advances, about the publishing industry that have come out. And I'm very grateful to Elle Griffin for compiling this stuff. She begins by quoting an exchange which occurred over the course of the trial with Madeline McIntosh, who's the CEO of Penguin Random House US. Question: do you know approximately how many authors there are across the industry with 500,000 units or more during this four-year period? So I believe the four-year period is since 2020. The CEO answers, my understanding is that it was about 50. The questioner, incredulous clearly, wanting to make sure that they didn't mishear, 50 authors across the publishing industry who during this four-year period sold more than 500,000 units in a single year? Yes. So only 50 authors. This is the CEO of the biggest publishing house in the world, or at least its US branch, revealing that. And things get even better from there. The DOJ's lawyer collected data on 58,000 titles published in a year and discovered that 90% of them sold fewer than 2,000 copies and 50% sold less than a dozen copies. So of 58,000 titles from Penguin Random House in a year, half of them sold less than a dozen copies, less than 12.
Well, I just want to say that such self-published tomes as The Important Cinema Club Journal and Moturn on Moturn have drastically outsold that low statistic, folks. We are in the upper 50%.
Buddy, there's a statistic later. I mean, there's some really fun stuff. We won't read them all about celebrity books that have flopped. Fuck, man, like the dead center is like nipping at the heels of Piers Morgan. Apparently his book, which has been out for a year, has sold like just over 5,000 copies or something. I don't know what I'm at now. I haven't gotten my royalty statement for 2023 yet, but it's pretty incredible. I mean, he's got like absurd numbers of followers on Twitter and Instagram. He's on TV constantly. I mean, it's absolutely incredible.
There was a recent book that there was a negative review of it that went super viral a couple weeks ago. Huge discourse topic on my timeline. And somebody posted the sales statistics for the book and it was like 600 copies sold in first week. This is a book, by the way, that like you've probably heard of, you know, wide front of the bookstore distribution.
Was it Canadian or American?
American. 600 copies would be great in Canada.
Well, in Canada, it's very much the case that you have books that get reviewed in national newspapers. Like you can get a review in the Globe and Mail and sell 500 books. That's not uncommon. The Canadian publishing industry is just very small.
Again, Moturn on Moturn, kicking some asses, it sounds like.
Now, there's a little more here that's worthy of note. The writer points out big advances go to celebrities. So there's a lot of discussion in the book of the scale of advances given to what publishers call anticipated top sellers. According to Nicholas Hill, a partner at Bates White Economic Consulting, 2% of all titles earn an advance over $250,000. According to Publishers Marketplace, it's even lower. It's fewer than 1%. Now, the bulk, it turns out, of all advance money, all advance spending, spent by Penguin Random House goes to deals that are worth $1 million or more. So a huge amount of the total gross advances that they're shelling out go to a very few people who get these really, really big advances, most of whom are celebrities. Now, some of these, very, very few of them, do well. Turns out that lots of these books actually don't break even. They lose money. So a big celebrity, someone who has a big name, big social media reach, can sell very, very few copies. And this is part of the business model. The writer here suggests that we should really think about big publishers as kind of like venture capitalists. That's what a lot of their behavior suggests. You know, they spend a lot of money knowing that a lot of it's not going to yield any return. But once in a while, you know, the chips are going to be on the right place and, you know, a book sort of, as it were, goes viral and they do really well. Now, apparently books by the Obamas sell so well that they can't even be included on any of the data charts that have come out of this trial, because they would just look like statistical anomalies. That's how well they sell. Having actually read Barack Obama's The Promised Land from cover to cover, I have serious doubts. You know, I'd love to see statistics about what percentage of people have actually read it who've bought it. I'm not being facetious here or tongue-in-cheek. I suspect it's less than 5%, possibly less than 1%. And that's not because it's a bad book. I mean, it is a bad book, but it is a much more engaging book than most books by ex-presidents. But it is a bad book in the sense that Obama cannot edit himself. He is so self-important. His prose, as ever, are so padded with all of these perfectly middle-brow allusions that weave his own autobiography into every facet of American history and culture that, you know, it just occupies pages and pages. He has to describe in encyclopedic detail the setup that he would find, like the pens of varying quality. Like, that's an actual turn of phrase that appears in the book. They would find at international conferences, that kind of thing. Anyway, most readers are not going to wade through a swamp like that. It's 800 pages or 700 pages. I can't remember.
Well, this reader over here read all of The Audacity of Hope in the year 2008. So it has happened.
Oh, yeah, me too. But that's a more digestible book. I guess you haven't seen The Promised Land, Will. It is a tombstone of a book, and it's only volume one. I can't wait to read volume two. And I suspect these will be like the Harry Potter books. Like, they'll just keep getting longer and longer. And then there'll somehow be a third one that's like a giant epilogue. That's, you know, that'll be his Order of the Phoenix. Now, there's some more in this piece, Will, that I think is interesting to consider, particularly in light of the conversations that you and I have been having on this podcast for several years about how the film industry largely works, or about how it works in relation to these big blockbusters, right? There's so much less risk these days. Movies need to cost more and more money. Big blockbusters, you know, can be $500 million now to film and to promote. And so increasingly, big studios, they're just leveraging existing IP, right? Everything's a sequel, a reboot, a prequel, some combination of all three. Well, something else that's come out of the antitrust trial is that publishing houses are very invested, major publishing houses this is, are very invested in authors that already have a built-in audience, as well as celebrities. So I think this is very much an analogous phenomenon. This is the literary equivalent of investing large sums of money in existing IP. And it turns out that a lot of these books, like I was saying earlier, a lot of these books by big names, like even these, completely flop. And I have to say, this was both sobering for me as somebody who is planning to write plenty more books in the future, but also was weirdly validating for me in the same way that, you know, I think hearing these statistics and you're thinking about Moturn on Moturn was for you. Because, look, I published the Dead Center with Orr. They don't have a giant industrial size, you know, promotional wing attached to them. They did what they could, but I promoted the book myself. I badgered podcasts until they had me on. You know, sometimes people came to me and said, do you want to come on my show? Do you want to be interviewed about this? But that was because they were aware of me already. Seeking Social Democracy, book I co-authored with Ed Broadbent. ECW Press did a great job on that book. But again, they're an independent Canadian publisher. They don't have a big promotional wing either. And, you know, we still pulled off a national bestseller. So all that's very validating. But on the other hand, I feel like I had kind of been operating in a world, and people who are older than me and have published more than me will probably chuckle at this, and fair enough. But I think I sort of naively thought that if you get a contract with something like Simon & Schuster, Penguin Random House, that just kind of means that, like, you know, your floor is that you're going to sell like 10,000 books. And I guess that's just not true at all. I mean, some of the stats here are truly eye-popping. Mary Kondo apparently had a book that flopped. The singer Billie Eilish, she has 97 million Instagram followers, 6 million followers on Twitter. I mean, her book sold 64,000 copies within its first 8 months, which is, you know, pretty good for most books. But I mean, for somebody that famous, it's not very good. Justin Timberlake sold 100,000 copies in 3 years of his book. She's not a celebrity in the same way, but certainly a very visible person. Ilhan Omar, she's got, you know, 3 million Twitter followers, something like 1.5 million on Instagram. Her book, This Is What America Looks Like, My Journey from Refugee to Congresswoman, that came out in May 2020. Apparently, 26,000 copies have been sold across all formats, so print, audio, and ebook. And then, yeah, there's this Piers Morgan one, which is great. The man has 8 million Twitter followers and, yeah, 5,600 US print copies sold in a year. publishers, it turns out, make a ton of money on backlisted items. And this is something I noticed as I was compulsively checking the charts, the sales charts for my two books. You think, oh, that's great. Like, look, in this category, we're at number 3 or number 5 or even number 50, whatever. And then you look at like the book that's like number 1 and it'll be something like The Bible, right? Or just, you know, 1984, like something like that. It'll be these kind of staple books. Dune is another one, actually. Dune has sold like unbelievable, like tens of millions of copies or something like that. So there are certain books that never go out of print and they just kind of do regular trade. And then whoever owns the rights to their publication is able to essentially just extract rent off of them, which is interesting. Another point here, Amazon is the biggest threat to the industry. Question, this is to the CEO of Macmillan. Are you concerned that Amazon will favor Penguin Random House, Simon & Schuster? So that would be the monopoly if the sale went through, the purchase went through. Are you concerned it will favor it in terms of promotion and distribution and discoverability? Answer, yes. So Amazon is such a big driver of book sales now that its algorithm really does determine to a large extent whether something becomes a bestseller or not. Oprah Winfrey had this power famously for many years, right? She could turn a book that was years old and not many people had read into like an international phenomenon and make the author a millionaire basically overnight. Now, something else, and I didn't know this, maybe I'm naive, is that publishing houses, big ones, pay for Amazon placement. Publishing houses try to game the algorithm both by paying out money, but also by hiring data scientists and things like that in order to get books to the top of lists. And again, if you're just saturated with advertising for a book on all of your platforms, I mean, I got a trial subscription to Audible recently, and you see this with audiobooks too. It's just certain things appear again and again. Like, it does not matter what kinds of books you listen to on Audible, what you have clearly indicated to the algorithm you're interested in and not interested in, it still wants you to read Michelle Obama. It's like, hey, have you heard the good news? Do you know about Michelle Obama? Do you want to read Michelle Obama? So no broader takeaway here, except that I think all of this is very interesting. And it also speaks to the fact that the literary world, the publishing industry, has clearly succumbed to the same monopolism as the rest of the entertainment industry. Authors are being cheated in many cases, but also readers are being cheated, I think, out of books that are interesting, that will never really see the light of day or which people won't really hear about. Ideas are being cheated because, you know, many of the best books, and, you know, this is a generalization, obviously, but many of the best books, like many of the best movies, originate from kind of an Archimedean point where, yeah, maybe the advance isn't, you know, $250,000. Maybe an enterprising editor at a publishing house sees a first-time author or a second-time author, whatever, that has an idea that's interesting, and they think the world needs to see this. This book deserves to see the light of day. We can't afford to pay this person $100,000, but hey, maybe we can pay them $25,000 or something like that. All of that, it seems like, is collapsing. And instead, what we're getting, as with, you know, big budget blockbusters, is this homogenized schlock that is very celebrity driven. It's very derivative. It's very rooted in ideas and people and brands and sentiments that already exist. And for that reason, it's incredibly unlikely to challenge or enlighten.
I don't want to hear anybody saying no. It's always, yes, sir, yes, ma'am.
Do you think it's possible to wash the sails?
This is a motorized vessel, so we don't have any sails.
We do want to talk a little bit about a movie on this episode, and, well, I'll give you a little backstory on how this episode came to be. Recently, Luke told me that he had just seen the movie Triangle of Sadness, and he asked what I thought of it. Now, this can be a fraught moment when somebody asks what you think of a movie, particularly one that is quite praised.
Can I interrupt you for a second? Notice, if you will, dear listener, how I put that to Will. I did not say, oh, I just saw this movie. What did you think of it? Here's what I thought of it. I waited. I put him in a position of vulnerability. I made him put the cards on the table. I alpha dogged him into giving me his take on the movie so that I could either agree with it or knock it down.
That's right. And what did I do? I got dommed, as always, completely subservient. I played right into your hands. I said, you know, I didn't really like that one. And you said, yeah, it was quite bad. So folks, here we are. We're going to talk a little bit about Triangle of Sadness. And if you like Triangle of Sadness, because it was quite a praised movie, Best Picture nominee, Cannes Palme d'Or winner. If you like it, I would just say, You're wrong, folks. You're wrong.
Well, look, I will say that I had a perfectly fine experience watching this movie.
I didn't, but go ahead. I loved being there for 2.5 hours seeing the same kinds of scenes over and over again. It was fantastic.
Look, this is just Will trying to alpha dog me back for what I did to him. And of course, as the movie teaches us, all human relations are fundamentally power relations. But look, to be clear, yeah, I think this movie's pretty bad. I think it very cynically weaponizes a certain kind of art house pretension to deliver what is a very bland and deeply uninteresting sentiment about human beings and human nature, which in fact very much finds a parallel in the kind of stupid nuance mongering we were talking about off the top of this discussion. When I say I enjoyed watching it, I mean that in the most conservative way possible. I mean, my partner and I were sitting down to dinner. We needed something to watch. I was curious about this movie because it had been, you know, an Oscar movie, like what, in 2023 or something, 2022, I forget. And it passed the time in a way that was not completely repellent. That is all I mean.
I hate to use the term art house in a pejorative sense, but art house funny in the year 2022 to 2024, as I would define it, is take a Michael Haneke frame, you know, a long, high definition static shot of something in the middle distance, and have that thing in the middle distance be somebody looking at their phone. That's art house funny. Anyway, this movie did win the Palme d'Or at Cannes. And I'd like to quote from a Letterboxd review that I really like by Gabe Klinger. He wrote, "Let's play a fun game of what was the Cannes jury thinking. Long festival. For the most part, everyone jet-lagged. Lots of confusingly interminable rides and limousines. Food is okay, but should be a little better. Foggy jury brain needs something blunt and overwritten and funny. Because mostly everything in this competition is a bleak drama, and I'm in a mood and need cheering up. And also something that makes me feel like a good liberal, but in sort of a mischievous both sides type of way that I don't have to take too seriously, etc. And here we are, stranded in this glamorous place, a famous Cannes publicist once aptly referred to film festivals as cruise ships. And this wacky movie is kind of an interesting mirror to the sequestered jury experience now that I think of it." So I think that's a pretty on-the-nose definition of the movie. This movie feels like a piece of, you know, parasite exploitation. Like sometime after the election of Donald Trump and, you know, around the time of Parasite, word got out that class disparity and class consciousness are good business. There's been a wave of movies like The Menu, Glass Onion, movies of varying quality that aim directly at the zeitgeist like this. And as Gabe Klinger says in the review, this is a sort of all sides, equal opportunity kind of offender. It comes out of the gate with a sort of dual assault on, first of all, vacuous Instagram influencers, as well as the class hierarchies as embodied by a cruise ship. And then in the second half, it kind of pulls the rug out from under you by showing power corrupts everyone.
Yeah, I'd like to reciprocate, Will, by reading the first paragraph of Richard Brody's review of this film in The New Yorker. Richard Brody, to his credit, was not buying at all what the film is doing. He begins the review thusly. "With his sourly playful satire, Triangle of Sadness, the Swedish director Ruben Östlund shoots fish in a barrel and displays them with an adventurer's pride. He takes on the easy targets of the obliviously rich and their glamorous entourages and delivers a handful of cafe table insights and would-be outrages that seem calculated to the millimeter. It's a movie of targeted demagogy that pitches its facile political stances to the preconceptions of the art house audience. Far from deepening those ideas or challenging those assumptions, it flatters the like-minded viewership while swaggering with the filmmaker's presumption of free-thinking, subversive audacity." Couldn't put it better myself. At the end of the discussion, I want to share another review, which, well, I'm hoping that you can help me unpack, which is by the National Review's Armand White.
Oh, yes.
A house intellectual of our podcast, as you well know.
Yes, please.
But look, I think that Brody is exactly right. You know, you're right too, Will. This is a film that is very much calculated to, you know, it announces itself right at the beginning and through various little things you see throughout it as like, this is an art film. This has things on its mind. I mean, the title cards between like the sort of breaking up of the movie into segments, you know, part one, Carl and Yaya, part two, the yacht, part three, the island. There are little touches like that. This kind of impressionistic opening sequence with male models and, you know, one of the main characters auditioning. I would just like to say here, you know, my girlfriend who worked in modeling for several years rightly took issue with what the scene was doing, because it is sort of designed to set up the couple who are the main characters as like people that have these easy jobs and they live these lives of leisure. And, you know, actually doing runways is very physically taxing. Perhaps a secondary point, but it's a good one. Now, Will, perhaps as the, you know, professional film critic between the two of us, you can explain what the symbolism, I can only assume there's some heavy-handed symbolism to be drawn from the line right in this kind of opening sequence from which the film draws its title. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, the triangle of sadness. The
pouty sort of face.
Yeah, exactly. The pouty face. First of all, don't sell yourself short. You're a professional critic too. To be honest, I'm not all that interested in the symbolism of it.
Well, I'm not interested in the symbolism either. I'm asking you what you think the director was trying to do. One of the two lead characters, Carl, played by Harris Dickinson, he's walking for a casting jury at this runway casting. And one of the jurors says, "Can you relax your triangle of sadness? Like between your eyebrows here, a little bit more. Okay, and open your mouth so you look a bit more available. Okay, not that much, a little bit less."
Is the triangle of sadness kayfabe, perhaps? I mean, we run into a number of characters in this movie. For example, Woody Harrelson as the captain of the boat, who's nominally a socialist, although as he admits later, he's a shit socialist because, you know, he lives in a society, etc. These Instagram influencers, they're vapid and they're all about exteriors. They're all about the way they look. There's the cook on the ship who in Act 3 becomes the sort of anti-hero of the film. You know, spoiler.
Well, we might as well spoil the whole plot right now so that we can put it to bed. I mean, the plot of the movie basically is that, yeah, Carl and Yaya, who are a sort of influencer couple, although she is more successful than he is, probably more talented as well, and makes more money. So the beginning of the film implies that there's a kind of asymmetry in their relationship, and Carl's uncomfortable with it. They join various rich people on this luxury cruise, on this super yacht. There's various banter with various characters. Woody Harrelson, our old pal Will, he's the captain. He's constantly quoting Chomsky and Lenin and Marx. But there's also some sort of Russian expatriate on the cruise, and he is an ardent follower of Ayn Rand and Ronald Reagan, and he's constantly quoting Margaret Thatcher, and the two of them quote these various things at each other.
And they bond in a way. They have a sort of drunken, fun argument as the ship is being overrun with food poisoning.
And also is caught in a storm and is, you know, heading towards the rocks, which, I want to talk about heavy-handed symbolism. The two of them are having this drunken debate about, you know, the respective merits of capitalism and communism, and the implication is like, as these ideologues trade in useless abstractions that have nothing to do with the real world, they should be focusing on what works. Why aren't they stealing the ship? The ship needs a Blairite captain who will get beyond these dogmas, who understands that you need to find practical solutions bit by bit. You know, you can't realize your goals through pure belief. And then the ship crashes.
I have one joke. Do you know how to tell a communist? It's someone who reads Marx and Lenin. And do you know how to tell an anti-communist? Mm-mm. It's someone who understands Marx and Lenin. It's Ronald Reagan, funny guy.
Never argue with an idiot. They'll only bring you down to their level and beat you with experience.
Mark Twain.
Oh, okay.
There's also an old rich couple who we find out made their fortune as weapons manufacturers, selling grenades and other weapons. And, you know, there's a, I guess, funny but heavy-handed moment where they get blown up by one of their own grenades. And this is an example of, of course, many of this movie's targets are deserving. Many of the scenes in the movie of like these rich people interacting with the service workers are sort of funny, but there are a lot of other targets too. And Ostland applies this sort of flattening effect to everything here. I was reminded of, who is it who said that Jonathan Chait's columns are written from the perspective of somebody who thinks it's as big a disgrace that a Kardashian is on his TV as there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? So you've got, yeah, these weapons manufacturers, and you've got vapid Instagram influencers, and the movie doesn't differentiate between them, and it also has no, like, empathy for the Instagram influencers. it's not the worst thing in the world to like want to get followers on Instagram.
Well, and also, and this is something Maddie pointed out, they're not on this cruise because they have as much money as these oligarchs that are on the cruise. They're not professional defense contractors. They're on the cruise because it's been gifted to them because they're influencers and somebody wants to advertise. So yeah, the movie and its flattening of everything and in its insufferable ersatz, chin-stroking attempts at wisdom and class commentary, it just flattens everything. I do have to quibble with something you said, Will, not really as a point of disagreement, but just because I kind of want to take what you said a step further. I mean, you said the film satirizes these rich people, but then it has other targets. I actually don't think the rich people are the targets of the film. What the film does, and this takes us to Act 3, when, you know, the ship crashes, the captain disappears, which, by the way, I thought the Woody Harrelson character disappearing was a bit of an odd choice, and I was convinced that the final twist at the end of the film was going to be him coming back in some way. But no, he just disappears. The survivors are on the island, and as you've said already, Will, Abigail, who is the ship's cook, played by Dolly de Leon, she's seemingly the only one who has any practical skills, and so she quickly becomes, you know, the main fulcrum of power among the survivors of this crash. Carl very quickly abandons Yaya and starts sleeping with Abigail, who is a woman of middle age, but the implication is he just wants to get close to power. And the message of the film, and really all that it's doing, comes to fruition in this final third. Before we tackle that specifically, I do just want to say that I actually think on a basic narrative level, I have a criticism of what happens in this sequence. I actually find it deeply implausible, and it speaks to how unbelievably cynical the message of this movie actually is, that you have a crash like this, and what the film then proceeds to show you actually occurs. If anything like this did occur, it would probably take weeks or months. Like, they crash, and then basically by the next morning, it's just Lord of the Flies, essentially. It's like we're in the state of nature. Abigail becomes the strong man. She moves into the lifeboat, which is kind of a roofed lifeboat that has room for 20 people, but it's just her. And then soon Carl moves in there with her. They get to sleep in there, you know, with shelter. She controls the rations and the supplies. And it seems to me that this is just very implausible. The basic idea that various kinds of social relations are contingent on, you know, like they only exist in a particular context, and when the context radically shifts, they dissolve. I don't necessarily disagree with that. So, I mean, if a bunch of people are on a cruise ship and then it crashes, and some of the survivors are staff and some of them are patrons, and, you know, the staff have had to have a very deferential relationship with the patrons on the luxury liner beforehand, and then that relationship is very suddenly dissolved by circumstances, I don't really have any problem believing that. Seems perfectly plausible. I do think, however, it doesn't follow from that that you immediately get a new hierarchy reasserting itself. I think particularly in the days after something like that happened, people would be cooperative and hopefully they would form new kinds of bonds with a view to their collective self-interest and no longer shackled to whatever, you know, hierarchical social relations were dictating or scripting their behavior before.
Well, this speaks to a very fundamental difference in belief between, you know, a conservative worldview and a socialist worldview. Is humankind fundamentally barbaric? Is humankind fundamentally selfish and self-interested? Obviously, you'll have no trouble finding many instances of selfish behavior in the world. You'll also find many instances of, you know, in communities everywhere, a barn burns up and the community comes together and raises funds to help that family. You see that all the time. Without telling Ruben Ostlund to fit into an easy socialist paradigm in his art, because obviously art shouldn't be doctrinaire, I think it's telling what his perspective of humankind is and what things he seeks to emphasize in his art, what things he chooses to believe. But watching this movie, I hear echoes of people saying things like, oh, socialized medicine. You really think a lot of people out there are going to want to pay more in their taxes for poor people or rich people to get healthcare for free? Ostlund's perspective is not that different from Will Stancil's perspective in that tweet earlier. He has this belief that he's a sort of neutral observer of human nature. when in fact, of course, there is a lot of ideology here.
Yeah, and I mean, this is where the film's kind of pretense to being an equal opportunity offender type movie really breaks down. Because, I mean, what conclusion naturally follows from the idea that, well, people are fundamentally cynical, inexorably cynical? Like, yeah, sure, Abigail was exploited when she was on the luxury liner. But look, now the hierarchy's broken down and she's just used the tools at her disposal in a new context to create a new hierarchy. Much to think about. The conclusion that follows from that, the implication of it is, and listeners will have to forgive me sounding like a cookie cutter internet leftist here, but the conclusion that follows is basically a neoliberal one, right? It's like, how should we think about human beings and their interactions? Well, what if each one of us was just a self-maximizing unit that enters into contracts with other people out of self-interest? Some rise to the top, some never do. Some exploit, some are exploited, but hey, look, it's a dog-eat-dog world. You can eliminate those social relations, and guess what? A new hierarchy will just emerge to replace them, so why bother? It is fundamentally a right-wing conclusion, and I feel perfectly comfortable saying that without having any illusions about whatever we think human nature is. I mean, I don't think we need to have an overly idealized view of human nature either. I think people obviously can be self-interested and greedy. And guess what? They can also be cooperative and compassionate. To a certain extent, those things exist in tandem within each of us, and they exist in tandem in varying degrees in society as well. The extent to which they exist, I think, and this is where the socialist perspective comes in and where it differs from the perspective offered by this film and its director, is that I think the extent of those things very much has to do with the structures of society, the social relations of society as they exist. This is true in a broad and abstract sense. You can also establish it empirically. There's all kinds of data that's come out of the Scandinavian countries in particular that shows that if a society is less commodified, if it's more horizontal, if social relations are less unequal, people are happier, they're less greedy, they're less driven by consumption, they're less competitive. And we don't need to be utopian about this either. In a socialist society in which, you know, we'd basically done away with the existence of class, you're still going to have crime, you're still going to have greed, you're still going to have people acting in a narrowly self-interested way, because people are still going to have the capacity for all of those things, but you're going to have them, in my view, to a much lesser extent. And that is where I fundamentally differ from the deep cynicism of this film. Now, Will, we should talk about the conclusion of the film. I mean, I will give the film credit. In a number of places, I actually did think, you know, the comedy landed.
You like the shitting and the vomiting, that stuff?
Yeah, I did, honestly. I mean, I guess, like, it is just pandering further to the kind of prejudices of the, you know, middle-brow film festival audience of which, you know, the film is targeted like a laser. It is kind of saying, like, oh, yes, well, if you enjoyed all this social commentary, oh, you might enjoy some shit and piss, a little bit of vulgarity.
Can I direct your attention towards a movie called Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, perhaps?
But whatever, I did find it funny just in isolation. The ship is sinking and, you know, this rich woman has been trying to use the bathroom. And yeah, by the end of the scene, she's just kind of like swimming in her own like feces and in other people's. And I don't know, it worked for me. There's also a kind of absurdist thing that happens in the final act. Once they get to the island and are marooned there, a scene where just a random kind of beach vendor approaches them and is trying to sell various wares. I mean, again, this kind of worked in isolation. Again, it is part of that annoying art house pretension of this film. And by the way, I share your concern, Will, about art house being used as a pejorative. People lean on that far too much. In this case, what we mean is the film is trying to establish itself as something worthy of the title and failing. But it wants to flatter you, the viewer, that you're watching something smart. That's what we mean by that. But yeah, as comedy, this kind of worked. It is very much partaking in a sort of like annoying derivative absurdism. You know, it's supposed to be like ironic counterpoint. You know, in the 2000s, a bunch of people watched The Sopranos and they noticed that the show would make very effective use out of, you know, you'd see something very violent or ugly and then the music would be something jolly or upbeat. And often the effect was very potent, very powerful. And then very quickly that became a device, and like everything else, the meaning was completely beaten out of it. And now it's just an annoying, heavy-handed thing that gets ported into all kinds of context, not to do anything smart, but to signify smartness. And that is what I think is fundamentally going on in the scene. God, it annoys me that even these things that I'm telling you I find funny, I then have to qualify by how annoying I also find them.
I caught the fish. Yes, I made the fire, and I cooked. I did all the work. And everybody got something.
Anyway, there is this kind of, I don't know, would you call it a twist ending here? Well, what happens at the end?
At the end, we find out it is not an abandoned island after all. There is a resort on the other side of the island. Abigail realizes that her reign at the top of this little ad hoc society they've built is about to end. And to hold on to it for just a little bit longer, she grabs a rock and is about to kill the other character that she's discovered this with.
And so Yaya, the female lead in the film, her back is turned and you know, they're about to enter the, you know, the door to this luxury resort in which, you know, the implication is, you know, all the old hierarchies will immediately be reestablished. And Yaya basically says to Abigail, oh, hey, you know, once we're out of this, I'll give you, you know, work as my assistant. And Abigail hesitates for a sec. There's maybe supposed to be some ambiguity here. I kind of think if we accept the film's logic, Abigail's probably going to kill Yaya here. I think the film is trying to be ambiguous. And then we just see Carl running through the jungle, converging on this scene. And that is how the film ends. I think we've done justice to it. However, we'd be remiss if we did not entertain perhaps a bit of a contrary perspective. You know, we like to accept all viewpoints on the Michael and Us podcast. We believe in bipartisan solutions and reaching across the aisle. So comrades and friends, I hereby submit to you The Delusional Triangle of Sadness by the National Review's Armand White, a cynical satire to impress Hollywood Marxists. Well, I'm hoping we can unpack this.
Can I just say that Armand White is interesting because if he were just a man on the street yelling into space, which is basically what he is, he wouldn't merit comment. But because he is the National Review's film critic now, he merits comment. So please go ahead.
So he begins by just announcing, you know, how successful the film has been, yada, yada. And I like this. He says, another Palme d'Or winner that says more about the state of European political attitudes than it does about art. And that's going to be important in a moment. The film's recent American premiere at the New York Film Festival rubber stamps this mistake. Triangle of Sadness is another of writer-director Ruben Ostlund's cynical comedies about social decay. His two Palme d'Ors ranks him among a select few European artistes. Ostlund's perspective on the West decline is so canny, reporting on characters caught up in the latest political etiquette, that the precision of his disgust verges on the uncanny. He then summarizes the movie for a little bit, recounting the details of the luxury cruise and the subsequent crash. This deliberate resemblance to the blood-gushing elevator in The Shining, he's talking about the poop scene, is an art movie stunt. It's also Ostlund's overstated Kubrickian misanthropy and a fet response to everything that has gone wrong in the world lately. Ostlund circumvents the current politicized documentary genre to satirize ruling class manners and morals. The hedonism and selfishness on view are an odd post-COVID subject. Triangle of Sadness takes place in a world without lockdowns and so seems to be commenting on the old free and open Europe. Yet Ostlund falls back on the Marxist class critique that is the European left's favorite solution to everything and the favorite delusion of the film festival circuit. So I just want to comment on his bleeding about, you know, the Europeanness of this film. It makes me think actually of something that another guy who I think was affiliated with National Review said during one of Christopher Hitchens' appearances on Firing Line. The way this annoying sort of B-stream conservative public intellectual whose name I'm now forgetting interprets Christopher Hitchens, you know, as he keeps saying stuff like, you know, it's because of Europeans that we have all this ideology now. I think this was in the 70s, you know. We used to have a very non-ideological society. And, you know, the mode of European politics, which is very ideological, has been imported into America, which is, I think, an interesting and sort of a recurring trope you see among American conservatives because, yeah, they really want to treat ideology as, you know, some kind of European intrusion, which is very funny to me.
So Armand continues, it takes Ostlund an indefensibly long time to play out this delusion. Well, Armand's correct here. Triangle of Sadness is divided into three sections, building to the no surprise revelation that the white West is greedy, racist, sexist, and ideologically decadent. American actor Woody Harrelson is cast as the captain of the $250 million luxury yacht, swapping political political slogans with the fertilizer magnate who boasts to sycophantic Carl and Yaya that he is the king of shit. These macho braggarts mock anti-communist bromides from Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, topping them with recitations from Marx and Lenin. The last capitalist we hang is the one who sold us the rope. But Harrelson beats that, reciting the assassinations of Malcolm X, MLK, and RFK. In each case, my government has had its finger on the trigger.
The twist that's coming, by the way, is so good. Hang on, folks.
Installing puppet dictators. War itself became an industry. So Armin says, somehow he misses the Wuhan origin of COVID and the lockdowns and Biden as puppet. Ostlund's instincts are off. The argument from the yacht's bosun about rich Russians versus crazy Russians misses the recent European attitudes about Putin and Ukraine. It's funny, there is still, in sort of like film circles, a tendency, you'll see it now and then with Armand White, sort of coasting on a reputation that he built 40 years ago to sort of be like, you know, he's crazy, but every now and then, you know, he'll throw something at the wall that sticks. And I would just say, he also throws a lot of shit at the wall that doesn't stick.
Yeah, what the hell is that? First of all, he's completely wrong about that scene. Like, he watches a movie and it's just he sees somebody quote Chomsky or whatever and is like, oh, so that means the film is Marxist. And he doesn't understand that the whole point of the scene is that, you know, the film regards the quotes from Marxists and socialists as equivalent in their triviality to the ones from, you know, Reagan and Thatcher, even though the film has politics that are much closer to the politics of Reagan and Thatcher. He completely misses that because he's just, you know, been triggered by certain reference points. But then what the hell is he doing there? He quotes the movie and then he's just somehow he misses the Wuhan origins of COVID and the lockdowns and Biden as puppet. What the fuck is he talking about?
But hey, actually, can I say in Armin's defense, as he wraps up this review, he brings some real fire. And this will answer some of your questions earlier about the symbolism of the title. Recounting the opening scene, you know, the catwalk modeling scene, he says, on the catwalk, Carl struts to loud dance music as a slideshow proclaims, everyone's equal. Act now, and cynicism masquerading as optimism. The latter, Brazen Cohen, restates Ostlund's Kubrickian operating principle. He pinpoints millennial delusion and condemns liberals for their disingenuous standards. For Ostlund, a model's face is a metaphor. The field of deception that defines contemporary behavior. The delusional disorder of our time. Ostlund is not Kubrick. He's just a misanthrope and a fraud. So no matter how faulty Armin's arguments in this article, no matter how much he's right from the wrong angle, I just want to say he is right there.
By the way, apparently the Abigail character, Armin says she's the toilet manager rather than the cook. The Michael and Us podcast regrets this error. Obviously, in fact, it seems to have slipped out of our brains.
My apologies, everyone.
Within finishing the film.
Good God.
Yeah, sorry, we're doing the work.
Oh my God, we're the new Armand White. Dropping wrong facts, faulty analysis.
Anyway, I am fascinated by this write-up because, as you say, I mean, there's a number of points where he is actually fairly perceptive about the film, but then because this type of conservative culture critic is so weighed down by certain grievances, like these very particular grievances that are just the propellants of everything in his circles, that in the end intrudes upon his ability to actually see what the film is doing. He keeps getting so close to understanding it. And then he's like, what about Biden, Wuhan, millennials? And also just constant appeals to this longstanding conservative bugbear about like how everything bad is European.
Well, that's true.
But then having done that, there's a reminder of his sort of earlier days as a less reactionary film critic where he says, Ostlund bungles the political, spiritual, and moral lessons of such classics about chaos as Louis Buñuel's Exterminating Angel, Antonioni's L'Avventura, and Godard's Weekend. Armand, tell us whether Europeans are good or not.
I've said this before, but one of the things I love about Armand White is he's only penetrable if you spent years reading him. So I'm just imagining all these National Review readers who have no idea who he is, no idea his background, just reading this incoherent mess of prose with all of these just chin-stroking references to, The Exterminating Angel and Godard and this and that, tied together in a way that makes no sense, and just like kind of stroking their chins and eventually getting to the part that says Wuhan and saying, Right, right, exactly, yes.
Right, people have come to NRO Online because they want to read a story about how the Frankfurt School is why their grandchildren won't talk to them. They want to read their 50th op-ed published that week about why the West is failing. Sometimes they want more indie fare, like maybe there's a guest op-ed from like a Jordan Peterson-like figure that's about how Disney is reprogramming kids so that they become non-binary. You've shown up to the National Review's website hoping to get some of this fare as a humble rank-and-file conservative reading the National Review, and all of a sudden, Armin White is inflicting on you references to Louis Bunuel. I kind of like Armin White now. Let's return to him again soon.
Well, there ain't nothing grosser, and I mean it for real, than watching a half-digested meal come spraying out of some person's mouth. I'm glad I'm not a little baby bird, tweet, 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 cause for a little baby bird, vomit is a treat that helps to fuel each winter's flight down south. Throwing up is just about the worst experience. Can't get that taste out of your mouth, no matter how much you rinse. It was so good going down, but coming up, it gives me a frown. There's no way that I can smile, tasting all that nasty bile. My girlfriend started puking. She wanted me to hold back her hair. She said, if you don't, I'm gonna dump you, cause it means that you don't care. I said, I'm sorry, honey, but I'll have to see you later. I'd rather break up with my woman than watch her puke up her mashed potatoes. Throwing up is just about the worst experience. You can't get that taste out of your mouth, no matter how much you rinse. It was so good going down, but coming up it gives me a frown. There's no way I can smile, tasting all that nasty bile.